Mr. Ward.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, Alex Campbell asked the Court to reverse his convictions for harboring for alleged extortion under the Hobbs Act and for sex trafficking under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, because in each case the record lacks critical things that the government needed to demonstrate for those convictions. And in the case of the harboring situation, the jury was not adequately instructed on what harboring really means. I want to get right to this harboring issue, Your Honors. And the government argued in its brief that the court's recent decision in Costello creates an effects-based test to demonstrate the intent that a harboring conviction must include. As an initial matter, by saying that there's an effects-based test, the government acknowledges intent is a critical part of this conviction. But the problem is, if we're calling it an effects-based test, we're simply wiping Costello away and putting the cart before the horse by saying, well, if the defendant does all of these things and the government shows it, then we can infer that he had the intent to harbor under the statute. But that's what Costello says is simply not true. In fact, that opinion says, and I'm paraphrasing, you can't separate the fact that they harbored an alien because of the fact that they were alien from the statute
itself. Counsel, has this argument been preserved?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Has this argument been preserved? The same instructions were used at the second trial as were used at the first. And apparently, your client said that was fine. Now, it was true. It was a prior lawyer who said that was fine. But litigants are bound by the decisions of their agents. You can't say, well, I got a new lawyer now, so my old lawyer's views don't count anymore.
Well, I think that's exactly what I am saying, Your Honor. I will acknowledge the government's point.
Then it hasn't been preserved, because I've got a new lawyer, so all my old waivers go away. It's not a recognized legal doctrine.
Agreed, Your Honor. And if it's simply a situation where we have new counsel involved, then the court's point is certainly true and the government's point is certainly true. We've got a different situation here where we have a mistrial in the first instance and a second trial. Now, as a general matter, the mistrial should wipe away the previous counsel's statements, particularly because the mistrial in that situation actually arose because of previous counsel's misconduct, which I don't believe anybody knew based on what I can see in the record. But the original trial counsel had some kind of past encounter with one of the government's witnesses, and that's what led to the mistrial in the first instance. So if the court's position is a mistrial does not, you know, wipe away the slate and give new trial counsel an opportunity to pass new opinions on the jury instructions, then absolutely the issue is weighed and it is not and just forfeited, as we argue. Our position that it is simply forfeited, the mistrial eliminates previous counsel's assent to the jury instruction. And that jury instruction is key, Your Honor, because if we agree, and I think we do, that intent is a key part of the harboring instruction, and under Costello and under several other circuits' recent decision, in fact, last year the Second Circuit specifically held that the harboring conviction requires intent to harbor the alleged victim specifically and precisely because that person is an illegal alien in the case. So that jury instruction is key because if we're to charge the jury to assess whether a defendant, in this case Mr. Campbell, committed the alleged conduct, then we have to know whether he did it for the purpose of the fact that the harbored individual was an alien. And without that understanding of what the necessary intent is, the jury can't assess whether the conduct was in fact criminal or not. And it's particularly problematic on these facts, Your Honor, because the government's argument critically was, and it's laid out extensively in their brief in the lengthy pages about what's called the family, that the reason Mr. Campbell provides these various resources, according to their argument, these residences, this money, cars, and so forth, is not to shield them from detection from law enforcement. It's not precisely because they're unlawful aliens in the United States. It's to, following their argument, which we of course disagree with, it's to further his sex trafficking activities, his sexual exploitation of these women, which, if that's true, certainly it's concerning to the court, but it's not for the purpose of their unlawful status in the United States. And without the instruction to understand what the jury needed to key into on the intent issue of harboring, it was not able to legitimately assess whether Mr. Campbell committed the crime charge. And that's what constitutes the plain error here, magnified then by the government's argument that the reason he purportedly provided these resources to the women was for something other than their immigration status. I'm going to move to the issue regarding both the extortion issue of the individual identified as Masha, as well as the interstate commerce problem with the Trafficking Victim Protection Act. The interstate commerce inquiry is different with respect to these two convictions, Your Honor, but it was problematic in both situations. On the extortion side of things, what we need to look at, and I think what Madison clarifies, is that we're not necessarily interested in the defendant's use of instrumentalities in interstate commerce. What we need to focus on, because it's an individual extorted here, is the individual's activities in interstate commerce. And the primary thrust of the government's argument and evidence in trial was that Mr. Campbell used instrumentalities in interstate commerce in the form of bank accounts that, while incorporated in Illinois, had out-of-state branches. He used cellular phone service that was provided through, I believe, an out-of-state carrier. And I think we can intellectually talk about the erosion of the concept of interstate commerce as a general matter. And that might be relevant to the sex trafficking issue. But here we really need to focus on whether the government provided sufficient evidence that Mr. Campbell's alleged extortion impacted MASH's activities in interstate commerce. And the level of evidence on that was minimal at best. I believe
Didn't he also have the belief that this money was coming in from Belarus to pay his demand?
I believe that was testified to by Masha, Your Honor. I may be incorrect. Right. There was also evidence that he did. But again, I think we're focusing on, and the government actually cited the Mitov case in its brief, which I think is interesting. And they focused on that case as providing legal support for the concept that if money is moving internationally, it supports the interstate commerce issue. But there's a critical difference between Mitov and our facts here. In Mitov, what the defendant wanted to do was move the money out of the country to a Belarusian radio station. So there was specific evidence in that case that the alleged victim's activities, he was intending to direct his funds that were being extorted, that he was attempting to export internationally and therefore into interstate commerce. That's a key difference that's present here, Your Honor, is that there's no evidence whatsoever as to what Masha would have done with these extorted funds or how she would have intended to use them had this alleged extortion activity not been going on.
But her parents overseas are being targeted as well. Isn't that what the evidence shows? That
She
was paying his extortionate demands in cash that was being supplied in part by her parents overseas. Why isn't that sufficient, even if the use of the phone and the bank account is not?
First of all, you're correct. That's definitely what the record shows. I think in this case we need to go back then to Madison and really focus on the issue is the victim's activities in interstate commerce. One of the key facts in Madison that the Seventh Circuit distinguished there was that I think the electrician at issue was not getting funds from his employer. But the court said during that case, even if he had been getting funds to provide that, to satisfy that extortionate demand, what we really need to focus on is what the impact on the specific victim's activity is and not necessarily what the broader potential impact on interstate commerce is. And that's the same situation that's here. Yes, I agree that the record shows that the funds are coming in from Belarus. And so if that is sufficient to hang the interstate commerce finding, then I cannot dispute that evidence, Your Honor. My position is that it's not sufficient.
The demand that she provide free services in the spa? Not the legitimate one, the illegitimate one.
Gotcha.
Wasn't that part of the fact pattern, that she could pay off this debt by working for free, basically, and that's, you know, a form of interstate commerce?
That was part of the allegation, or I believe that's correct.
That's caught on the tapes? I mean, after she went to the government, we've got this established more concretely on the tapes that he was extorting her services as well, right? As well as the money from her parents.
That is included in the evidence, Your Honor.
And I sort of took that to mean that the government was trying to shore up the Hobbs Act claim.
Quite possibly, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. If we're going to focus on the provision of services in the spy, I still think there's an evidentiary gap that those specific services were interstate in nature. We don't know anything about the specific customers involved, whether they were out-of-state, in-state
customers.
Well,
we do know that the business served interstate commerce, right?
I don't think that we know, Your Honor, that the business served interstate commerce. I agree that there is evidence that the businesses used the instrumentalities of interstate commerce and the fact that it had phone service. And it supplied or it obtained advertisements through out-of-state organizations. And I think that's really got to funnel us back then, Your Honor, to this erosion of what is interstate commerce. I'm not an originalist. I certainly don't think that we should be up here saying that, you know, unless someone is specifically driving over state lines to engage in business, that's the only time that we have interstate commerce. But I do think we need to be careful in this day and age to still preserve the concept of interstate commerce, because if we don't, it simply ceases to exist in our modern era. I mean, I'm going to leave this court and probably answer a bunch of emails from people who are five blocks down the street from me, because that's where our office is. But those emails went through an Ohio server, because that's where our firm is based. And if that's going to be considered interstate activity, then there is no concept of interstate commerce anymore, because we're so globalized and the technology age has brought this nation together and brought communication channels together so incredibly that interstate commerce has no meaning if the mere use of a phone with an Illinois area code to another phone with an Illinois area code is interstate commerce, because Verizon is incorporated in Delaware. So I think we need to be careful of that. What we know in this extortion situation is we don't have any evidence that these services were interstate in nature, other than the fact that the business used some cross-state instrumentalities, because at this day and age, Honor, it's virtually impossible not to do business.
Is there evidence that the clientele was interstate?
I don't believe that there is, Your Honor. I don't believe that there's any evidence that it was interstate. I'd prefer to use my remaining moments for rebuttal, Your Honor, unless there are any questions at this moment.
Certainly, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Greenwald.
Good morning, Your Honor. Helene Greenwald on behalf of the United States. Beginning with the harboring issue, just to complete the record on the waiver issue, the transcript from the first trial is available, but hasn't been made part of the record on appeal. I will do that when I leave here today, but I would proffer to the court at this point, but it will be in the record on appeal, that while it was previous counsel's having gone to one of these spas and met one of the witnesses, not one of the victims, but used her services at the spa prior to it, that raised a whole mistrial issue. Ultimately, the government at that trial was willing to withdraw that witness's testimony, not proceed with it, to avoid any kind of conflict. And the reason that that lawyer did not maintain was the defendant's position that he could no longer trust or communicate with that counsel. But it wasn't a record that suggests, I just don't want the court left with the impression that there was some kind of conflict issue or some kind of unresolved attorney misconduct issue,
well,
per
I'm,
se.
I'm not really sure that any of that matters. The fact remains that there was a mistrial.
Yes,
and
there
so
was a mistrial.
And so why doesn't that wipe the slate clean as far as waiver forfeiture issues are concerned?
Here's why, Your Honor. Because in this case, the district court took its second trial, discussed the jury instructions on all of them with reference to what happened at the first trial. In other words, the court didn't start from zero with the jury instructions. The court said, we had a jury instruction conference in that case. I'm starting with what came out of that, and any objections made by prior counsel are preserved. And so that,
converse true? That any waivers by prior counsel?
He didn't expressly say that, no,
yeah.
Your Honor.
So I think we have to give the benefit of
the government's
doubt.
Position is based on this court's precedent and its strict construction of waiver in the context of jury instructions. We made the argument. But I'll move on to the merits of it, which are dealing with the harboring issue. What the parties are agreed on it is at the minimum it's a plain error standard of review that's in place here. And under Costello, the court, the government maintains, expressly rejected any kind of specific instruction on that there be a specific intent for the purpose of keeping the alien from government detection for purposes of harboring.
Well, it's hard to find that real clear, crisp statement that says that.
I would say it's said that by the example of the restaurateur. Well, I'd say it's found in two places, Your Honor. One, the example of the restaurateur that they keep going back to, and in particular the court says, they calls that that example a perfect case of harboring, but might be a weak case of concealing if the court, if the defendant could convince the jury that concealment was not the purpose in housing them. Additionally, the court was very cognizant of there are circuits that do the Ninth Circuit opinion holding that there is a specific intent for harboring. It notes it and then goes on to formulate a test that does not use that language at all. But even if there is such a requirement of such a specific intent, the failure to give such an instruction here, which would have been promulgated by or interpreted by this court post the trial in this case, the failure to give that instruction does not meet the plain error standard. It does not represent a miscarriage of justice that the defendant probably would have been acquitted but for the error, nor in the context of insufficiency of the evidence does this record show that it is devoid of any evidence on this point. In sum, this defendant gave each of these victims in the harboring counts new names to use with everyone they encountered in the jobs and the housing he provided them and had them stop using their real identities. He took and hid all their identification and documentation with their real names and revealing their true citizenship status, including their passports, their visas, their driver's license. He took and hid the credit cards and checks and bank records that they all had as they came into his domain. He took their phones. He directed them to have no contact or allowed very limited contact with anyone, including their real family, who was outside of his family, and he directed them not to provide anyone the address of housing he provided. He specifically told, and this is the testimony in the case, that he told that Diamond testified that she was told that she needed to move out of the housing she shared with her roommate and into housing the defendant provided because he thought her roommate was jealous of her and would report her to immigration authorities. And he told Diamond, do not give that new roommate this new address where I'm putting you because she could report you. And finally, he told Diamond and Lonnie not to reveal their true identities or anything about their past, which necessarily included their legal status, to anyone.
On some occasions, though, he allowed or even required them to use their real identities, didn't he?
So when that happens, Your Honor, I think that defense counsel is taking it out of context. For example, it is true that when he is courting Diamond, and I'm using the name he gave her, when he is courting Diamond to come to join his family, when he's in that courting stage trying to get them to come in, he tells her, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to give you an apartment. And he takes her and he puts an apartment in her name, and she signs a lease, and she meets the real estate agent who knows her by her real name, and he puts her in that apartment, and as soon as he's got that tattoo on her, and he's got her working at his massage parlor under his control, he moves her out of there, and she never returns there. And she's only known by Diamond. So if immigration was to find out that this person was an illegal immigrant and went to that apartment, nobody would know who they're talking about because there is no person by that true name. And she's not there. She's living in his spas. She's living in other places that he secretes her and puts her. That's one example. Another example is the accident that Lonnie has. Lonnie's driving her a car. She has an accident. He takes Lonnie out and he sticks Diamond in to tell the police and gives her driver's license to tell the police I was driving it. The government argues the evidence indicates that he thought he had Diamond more under his control than he had Lonnie. And that was just a tactical of-the-moment decision where he appears in front of the police with Diamond to kind of protect Lonnie and protect his control. I shouldn't say protect Lonnie, his control of Lonnie. So it was an expedient situation that he got thrown into there, to use the license. So the record viewed in the light most favorable to the government suggests that these exceptions all need to be put in context of his scheme. And I would also go to the point that defense counsel is absolutely 100% right. It was the government's theory of the case, and certainly consistent on appeal, is that he was doing all these things to control these women, to make money off of them, to traffic through them. But part and parcel of that was keeping them here and not having the authorities find out about them. That was right there with that. And I would cite to the case, as we do in our brief, Vargas versus Cordone, a Second Circuit case that applies the intent to the specific intent test and comes out and says, in particular, that there's sufficient evidence of intent to protect, to prevent detection by authorities where defendant's motivations were both, in that case, to continue his relationship with the victim and to prevent authorities from finding the victim. So I believe the law, even if defense counsel is correct on its interpretation of Costello, supports the government's position, and certainly under the plain error standard review we're on. Moving to the Hobbs Act, so this case is not a case on the edge or on the cusp of interstate commerce where the government's asking the court to reach or asking the jury to reach. This case, the whole nature of the extortion here screamed interstate commerce in every way, and the extortion of Marsha had a direct effect on interstate commerce by virtue of her very status as an illegal alien from Belarus and the nature of the extortion, which intimately involved her immigration status and her parents in Belarus. Defendant targeted her for what started as a fraudulent visa scam and evolved into extortion because of her very status as an illegal alien trying to live and work in the United States. His threats included sending this sex tape to her parents in Belarus, posting it on the internet for circulation worldwide, having her deported, and harming her parents in Belarus. It involved long-distance phone calls from Illinois to Belarus, which were essential to his being able to contact Masha and facilitating the event. And it required that Masha pay thousands of dollars or alternatively work for his business without pay, a business that itself was a commercial establishment that operated in interstate commerce by advertising on the internet, purchasing items in interstate commerce, and even employing women from, and I use that word in quotes, employing women from foreign countries. And finally, the interstate commerce element is met here by evidence, not just from Masha, but from the undercover or the consensually recorded tapes, showing that defendant had every reason to believe that the money Masha would use to pay this, to pay the extortion demands, were going to come from her parents in Belarus. All of this was more than sufficient to satisfy the interstate commerce element. And it is not, I believe defense counsel is misreading the law when he says that it must, you know, affect the victim's activities. The requirement under the statute is that it affect, that the extortion affect interstate commerce. And Mattson and the other cases upon which he's relying are depletion of assets cases, which certainly can be relevant with an individual, certainly is hard, much harder to prove with an individual. This wasn't a depletion of assets case. This was a direct extortion, a direct effect on interstate commerce by these numerous ways this is affecting.
How does the use of the phone calls or the use of the phone affect interstate commerce? It's obviously
the
use of,
right.
It's the use of instrumentalities, but that's not effect. The statute uses the term effect.
And the record supports that this phone was used, that there were calls placed from Illinois on these cell phones to Belarus, to her parents, by Diamond, at defendant's direction, in order to get her telephone number here, Marsha's, because she changed her number.
Right, that's using the phones as an instrument of the extortion. It's
well,
not
Your Honor,
proof
there,
that the extortion affected interstate commerce.
Well, Your Honor, there is case law that says that out-of-state phone calls used to facilitate the extortion, for example, calls to arrange for your co-conspirators to come to the state. There's a robbery case, which is also covered by the extortion statute, where after getting robbing someone of their credit card, they called to check on the balance on that credit card. That use was termed, because it facilitated the robbery, was viewed as sufficient for the interstate commerce nexus. So there is case law that says when it's an out-of-state, when you're using it to make long-distance calls to facilitate the extortion,
right. Is that
it's sufficient.
Good? Is that good law? I mean, is that a proper interpretation of the Hobbs Act?
Because then every local crime becomes...
It's well-established interpretation of the Hobbs Act, Your Honor. And I think in the context of this case, where there's so many other additional...
I mean, you've got other evidence, but this is a really aggressive argument, and maybe there's case law to support it, but to suggest that anytime you use the phones...
I don't think it's anytime...
You've violated the Hobbs Act.
I agree, Your Honor. I think it would be an aggressive argument if we were saying, as defense counsel was saying, when you call within the state of Illinois. But we're not saying that. We're targeting specifically these calls on the cell phone to Belarus. Specifically to Belarus. And that, I believe, the cases we cite in the brief, and they're not, they include recent cases, and they're not newly developed law, that is sufficient. And I would also just urge the court that in particular here, where the whole nature of the extortion was to get funds from Belarus, to send, the threat itself involved sending things to Belarus. It just also buffers it as well. But a sole intrastate telephone call, I agree with Your Honor, that would be aggressive. I just don't think that's what we really have here. I don't think that's what the jury had to find in order to convict here. Because by necessarily finding the nature of the threat here, they necessarily had to find that this threat involved the threat to send sex tapes to Belarus, the threat to hurt her family in Belarus, the threat to put it on the internet in Belarus. All of that had to be found by the jury here in order to convict just on the extortion element. And that in itself wrapped up the interstate commerce as well. In addition, on the sex trafficking, I believe he touched on that just a bit, and just in it, you know, we would rely on the arguments we make in our brief in there, as well as, you know, you don't even have to get to this whole clean spa, dirty spa argument, because Diamond testified that defendant had me live and provide sexual trafficking services at Club Tan and El Spa, and while I was there at his directive, I placed ads for those establishments on the Backpage, on Craigslist, things that would have circulated to a certainly outside of Illinois clientele. And whether clients from those states actually came really isn't part of the inquiry on the established case law. Just placing those ads for those institutions, again, under the Myers case, the Todd case, we're not creating new law here. It's bound to be sufficient. In addition, I see my time is up. So unless Your Honor has any questions, we would respectfully rely on our brief and our argument here today and ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, Counselor. Anything further, Mr. Ward?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. A few points, we'll see how quickly I can move through them. I want to make the quick point, Madison's not a depletion of assets case, Your Honor, and I think that's why it's the key case on the Hobbs Act issue. That's an individual case that really laser-focused on the fact that we need to address the effect of the purported extortion on the individual's activities in interstate commerce, which is really what we're looking at here. On the harboring issue, Your Honor, the government gave a very long list of all of the various things that Mr. Campbell allegedly did. The problem is the government also acknowledges he did these to control these women to further his alleged sex trafficking activity. And we also think he did it because they were aliens and he could control them and keep them here. Well, Danielle John's not an alien, and she's part of this enterprise as well. And here's where we get into the issue why we need an instruction on this, Your Honors, is that if there's mixed evidence on the purpose for why Mr. Campbell provided this stuff, then the jury needs to understand what's relevant and what the purpose is for what conviction. And certainly a reasonable jury could reasonably doubt, given the extensive evidence for why he controlled them to, or provided things to control them, that it was for the purpose of his sexual enterprise and not their illegal status in the United States. And while I agree with the court's comment that Costello, while it's very clear that intent is critical, it's hard to sit there and find that exact line that says we need to give a jury instruction on this. It certainly doesn't disclaim the need for a jury instruction. It cites the Ninth Circuit case, apparently with approval. You've got the Second Circuit specifically finding that intent is key on this. And when you've got varying motives, such as the government has acknowledged here, it's critical that the jury understand what it needs to find in order to convict when there are really different theories going on here. Absent that instruction, the jury simply was looking at, are these women illegal? Did he provide them shelter. Did he know they were illegal? Boom, harboring conviction. And that misreads Costello, and that's why the instruction is so key and why its absence in this case was a plain error. I like the government's comment as well that this screamed interstate commerce. Everything screams interstate commerce these days, Your Honors. If Diamond goes to Club Tan, and I can't recall the other spot, and the reason why Mr. Campbell engaged in interstate commerce is that she posted something on Craigslist, and we don't know where on Craigslist. If the court's familiar, you can limit the geography on Craigslist to where you want advertisements to go, even though it's based, I think, in California or Arizona. If that's interstate commerce, then every business is always engaged in interstate commerce every day, or it's not going to exist anymore because it's going to go out of business because it's not on the internet. So we really need to be careful on what the interstate commerce issue is with these things. And if sex trafficking based purely on intrastate activity becomes a federal crime, any sophisticated pimp, and excuse my language, any sophisticated prostitute who uses technology to further a business is committing a federal crime, mm-hmm. and that's really where we don't want to go.
Thank you, counsel.
Appreciate the court's time this morning.
And we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case, Mr. Ward, and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
My privilege, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.